No Jumper, coolest podcast in the world. And today we're in here with Steve Rifkin. How you doing, Steve?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent indeed.
Just staying cool in this nice, you know.
I mean, you know it's hot out because like we have the AC cranking, but we're still kind of hot.
Well, you were wearing, I was going to wear a sweatshirt too earlier, but it's, you know, but it's definitely like 104 degrees out.
It's easier to style when you have some sort of larger garment, you know, t-shirt and shorts. It's kind of hard to make it look good.
Exactly.
Especially being older white guys. Like it's not easy. But have you completely given up on the fashion side of your life? Or did that happen at some point?
I was always a sweatpants guy. So when I was younger, I would love to go into meetings like with CEOs and chairmen and just wear a sweat outfit for shock value.
Yeah, people are always kind of shocked that I can get away with it and that I choose to. Slight interruption there. Did you consider that? Because like now I feel like it's so hip-hop to get dressed up a lot. Whereas like, you know, I could see that side of things too, where it feels like you go into a label meeting and you just got sweatpants on. That's pretty badass too.
No, so it was definitely label, but I had another company, which was a marketing company.
Mm-hmm.
And we were dealing with Fortune 500 companies, and I would still, you know, I'd have a meeting with the CEO of General Motors. And if it's during the summer, I'm wearing this.
Right.
You know, one time, you know, we had a meeting with Ralph Lauren. Ralph Lauren.
The guy.
The guy.
Not the brand.
I went in with a bathrobe. Just to even out the playing field.
And how do you think that went over?
It went well. We got the account.
That's beautiful. You know, okay, when you mentioned the street team, there was this observation that I heard somebody make at some point. Maybe I'll just claim it as my own. But they said that Master P conceptualized what the internet was going to be like before he had access to that technology, in the sense of dropping constant projects and like really blanketing his area with this content that, you know, it would make a lot more sense if he had been doing that on the internet, but he sort of figured it out before that was readily available. When I read about you and the street team and stuff, it kind of stands out to me as like you almost figured out digital marketing before digital marketing was available.
I appreciate that. Maybe. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it. I'm still trying to figure out digital marketing now. But, you know, the thing with Pete, I don't know. That concept was incredible. But to me, the reason why he did it, and me and him never even had a conversation about it, was the only way to get paid. Right? So because he was going through Priority, even though they were indie, but they were with a major. So the thing was to get as much product as you possibly can. And just keep on coming so you know that you'll get paid. Because if you're going to put out a record once every few months, the distributors in those days wouldn't pay you.
Right. That makes sense. Were you, when you look back at, or when you look at, you know, marketing a record now, does that era of the street team being like your main way of heating an artist up, does that seem kind of quaint? Do you like miss that era?
I miss it because that I really understood it. You know, I'm in business now with my nephew. I don't know where he went. And my son, you know, and they're all about digital marketing. And I just want to pull I have no hair, but it's just like,
right.
Like, no, we gotta own the streets first still. And then all this digital shit come with that afterwards.
Okay.
And they look at me like I have four eyes.
Really?
Yeah.
So you still think that putting up posters and
I'm not talking about putting up posters. Because even in those days, I didn't think putting up posters, like, what is that really going to do?
Right.
Because you're walking by so fast or you're driving by so fast. To me, it was always putting the record in the right hands of the right people. And to me, that's what street marketing was about. Not going to the top of the Empire State Building and vinyl wrap the fucking antenna. Of the Empire. I mean, who's going to look up 100 floors? You know, so to me, but it was like, you know what? If the doorman and give him a box of stickers or posters and everybody that's walking through,
right.
That's something else. But just to put up a poster, that I didn't believe in that.
Really? So that wasn't a big part of what you were doing?
I mean, it was a part because people was what we did were pun.
Mm.
You know, we took, you know, Joe said, let's just blanket the whole West Side Highway.
Right.
And we, you know, so it was like one big mural from like 180th Street to 54th Street.
Right.
Right. So if you were going south and you looked right, all you saw was a big pun.
And would you really feel like the temperature change in terms of artists after campaigns like that? Like, because, you know, New York City is such a bubble that you can imagine that having everybody driving down the West Side Highway one day seeing this shit, that could really actually, like, make something change in terms of that artist's trajectory?
I mean, I think, sorry for cutting you off, I think people were saying, like, who the fuck is he and what is that?
Right.
But again, you know, with the posters and the stickers, you know, when they started covering stop signs, you know, it was just like, and the fines came and this, that, so on and so on. You know, to me, I was like, nah, let's, you know, I want the record in the right hands with the guys. And it wouldn't necessarily be a radio DJ. It could be a club DJ. It could be a mobile DJ. Just somebody that has an audience and somebody that knows how to attack their audience.
Mm.
And that's really what, to me, the grassroots promotion was supposed to be.
Yeah, definitely. So when you are, you know, working an artist, do you stick your head into dealing with the, you know, getting girls to dance to the record on TikTok? Is that something that you...
That's my nephew and my son are doing. No, I'm not doing it. I'm saying, all right, we got to find a brand, and we're gonna just blanket. If you're from... We have an artist called Bird Bennett,
okay,
right? And he's from Portland. I want to own the Northwest.
Okay.
So let's own the Northwest, and then all that digital shit could come after the fact.
Mm.
But, you know... So that's my argument with my nephew and my son all day.
So if you were to sign a New York City rapper right now, you would go in trying to make him pop in New York City specifically to start and then branch out from there? You still think that that's an important step?
I think you have to own the streets. If you're going to be in the hip-hop game, you still have to own the streets. So if you look really what Quality Control is doing, right, they still own the streets. And whatever digital stuff they're doing with it, is just, to me, that's the gravy.
Right.
But, you know, the Migos wouldn't be who they were if they didn't have a real street presence.
Right.
Especially down south.
Mm. Does it occur to you at times, though, that it seems way easier to make a street artist pop off? There's just like an inherent desire to see what these guys are talking about when you're talking about like a Pooh Shiesty or somebody along those lines.
Yeah, it's one press of a button. Right. But I don't know if you're getting a real audience. That's what I'm fighting with.
Mm. Is how to... You don't have as much faith in that audience that sort of comes along with that?
No, I'm not saying I don't have faith. I'm just saying, how real is it? Is this guy going to be able to make records 20 years from now? Is he going to have a loyal following? You know?
Right.
So that, you know, so that's what I mean by owning where you come from, or your foundation, or your base.
Right. Do you still feel like you gravitate more towards that sort of like hardcore street type stuff, or like stuff that is in that real, real rap category? Or do you feel comfortable working in other fields at this point, or does it still feel kind of foreign?
You know, no, it doesn't feel foreign. It's a great question. So when I left Loud, right, I sold to Sony. I had to work with a company that I started.
Okay, and what year are we talking again?
I sold that in 99, and then okay, I had a three-year deal where I had to go work for Sony for three years.
Which is weird, because to a lot of the young kids, Loud as a brand name might not mean as much to them. But in that time period, this was omnipresent.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was really, you know, there were three labels, really. It was us, Bad Boy. Def Jam was a major by that time.
Right.
And Death Row. Uh-huh. Rockefeller was just starting.
Right.
So when, but I worked for a company, right? So I had Woo, Mob, Pun Pass, but Pun, MOP, Dead Prez, Exhibit Licks, 3-6 Mafia, all street orientated artists.
Mm.
When I left, I went over to Universal, started SRC Records. That was supposed to be called, and that stood for Street Records Corporation.
Mm.
And I thought it was going to be like Loud 2.0, you know, on steroids. But what did I come with? I came with Akon. I came with Asher Roth. I came with a woman by the name of Melanie Fiona. I came with another woman by the name of Chantel, who had two top five pop records. David Banner. You know, so, and Universal was radio driven. So I had to change my philosophy. I still wanted to own the streets, but I had to change my philosophy about what type of records I was going to put out.
Right. Did that feel like you were compromising your vision, or did it feel like this was just survival in terms
It wasn't about compromising my provision. I mean, my vision. It was about survival. If I wanted to have success, you know, I'm going to have to play by that way.
Right.
And we went on a run that was just as big as Loud. I mean, Akon was the biggest artist in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's important, too. Like, you know, even with the Asher Roth thing, obviously he didn't really become what I think a lot of people probably thought that he could have at a certain point. But, I mean, with Akon, with Asher Roth, I mean, that's kind of indicative of the changing face of hip-hop that in the lead-up to that, that probably didn't seem terribly obvious that there was going to be so many different types of rap stars since, you know, and throughout the 90s, it was pretty consistent, like one type of rapper over and over.
Yep. Yeah, and then, you know, the internet was coming, ringtones was coming, iTunes just came in, right? I think iTunes came in like 2000, 2001.
Right, so long before it became standard.
Yeah, so we started SRC in 2002, and, you know, I remember getting a phone call from somebody who I'd never even heard of at Universal, and he says, you have the number one ringtone record, and I'm like, what the fuck does that even mean, and what is a ringtone?
Right.
But you know what? It saved it. We made a lot of money with those ringtones.
Definitely. And it's just, that's what's so interesting about the music business is that there will be this income stream for a period of time and then it just sort of withers away and then there's another flow that it goes into. But when you think back to, you know, like when did it really feel like the music industry might be totally fucked? Was there a period there where you were like, wow, maybe nobody's going to be making any more money from this?
So when we came with Akon's second album.
Right.
If that was in the 90s, that album would have done 30 million records.
Right.
Album sold. Scan, across the board, everything else like that. I think in 2000, we peaked at 8 million.
Uh-huh.
And
that felt like a letdown.
As big as those records were, it was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
As big as those singles were, if this was 95, 96, 30 million would be one of the biggest albums of all time.
Mm-hmm.
No questions asked.
Right. But instead, what do you blame? Like the piracy, the copyright, or the online sales, or probably a little bit of everything?
I don't know what I blame, to be honest with you. I think retail was going down, and I think people were missing going to retail, too. But I really don't know, and it was becoming a single-driven business. So the ringtones, like, 8 million, I mean, shit, that was still $80 million in billing alone.
Right.
You know, just like that. So, but with the ringtones, you know, but if we did, say we did 15 million, not 30 million,
uh-huh.
You're talking about 150 million in billing.
Right.
Right? So maybe we topped out at 90 with all the ringtones. And everything like that. So it's, and it was a single, and it started turning back into a single driven business. In the 90s, it was all about albums.
Right. How do you feel about albums now?
There's no more. I mean, the deals I'm doing with everybody now is just all about delivering me 20 singles.
Really? Interesting. I had a Hobson on here the other day. You know, he kills it on YouTube with his singles. He does a YouTube video, got 10 million views, whatever. Last time I interviewed him 3-4 years ago, he said he wasn't sure if he was ever going to put an album out again. I just interviewed him again. Still no album since 2017. He just doesn't even see any reason for him to do it anymore.
No, he's probably making a fortune, too.
Yeah. But does that... Okay, so when you say 20 single deal, so there's...
You got to deliver 20 masters. Not all going to be singles. And then we'll pick what we just want to put out.
Okay. So you're but that feels kind of contradictory to what you said about like when you get an artist that you're concerned about where their career is going to be at in 20 years. But the nature of the business now is that there's tons of artists who have like a 6-month career, and there's probably plenty of money for you to make off of those artists, right?
Yeah, but I mean, the roster that we're picking, my gut and my soul won't let me do just a one-hit wonder type of thing.
Right.
I'll never pick up a novelty record in my life.
Really? Is it just a matter of pride?
No, it has nothing to do with pride. It will be, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to be spending the same amount of money. Mm. So might as well spend the money on somebody that's going to have a follow-up.
Right. Interesting. But, I mean, there's viral records that just make shitloads of money, right?
There are, but that's something that I'll just let it go right over me.
But that kind of all comes back to like why you're doing this in the first place, right? Do you feel like you're doing this for money? Do you feel like you're, you know, I'm sure you're far past the point of like really needing another mill, right?
I'm doing it to be in business with my nephew and my son.
Really?
I mean, I don't have to work anymore.
Right. Why were you doing it when you started?
My family was in the music business.
Right.
So I was major.
A lot of kids reject what their dad does.
I didn't have a choice, really.
really?
I was majorly dyslexic. I didn't know how to read or write until I was 14 years old.
Right.
So I was getting in a lot of trouble. And my grandfather called me down to Florida, where all Jews go when they retire.
So I hear. I heard that in Seinfeld. Yeah, they taught me about that.
And my grandfather said, you're going to end up dead or in jail. You got to get your shit together.
Right.
And he goes, why don't you go work for your father? I said, my father's not going to want anything to do with me.
Right.
He goes, I'll call him. So they sent me on the road. Now I'm 18. This is 1980.
Right.
Spring of 1980. And they decided they're going to send me on the road for 2 weeks. And 2 weeks ended up being 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Where I just zigzagged across the country visiting radio stations. Then I would find myself back at colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I ended up putting the street team together.
Right. To a lot of people, that would sound like a not fun way of life, just being on the road 24/7. And did you just fall in line with it right away? And did it seem like a compromise in any way? Or were you just excited to be?
No, I wasn't excited. I enjoyed not looking over my shoulder, like the cops could have come, you know, this, that, you know, whatever. But yeah, I mean, I enjoyed end up going back to the colleges and just, you know, talking music, talking sports and, you know, whatever current events was really going on.
Right.
But I zigzagged this country 4 different times.
Right. And at that time?
There was no GPS. There were no cell phones. I would be in the car with $20 worth of quarters.
What was your ambition at that time?
My ambition was to live.
Did you think that you could do very well for yourself at that time from this work?
I wasn't even thinking about that.
Mm.
I wasn't even thinking about that.
It's easy, yeah, because once you've made it, people start assuming that you had a plan all along.
I mean, I was 18, so I mean... I grew up okay. It's not like, you know, when I was getting in trouble, I wasn't doing it because I needed to. Mm-hmm. I was doing it just to get attention.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Did your dad, like, what was his viewpoint on you dealing with all these rappers?
My dad put out the first rap record of all time.
Okay.
My dad gave Russell Simmons his first record deal.
Right. But did he see it as, you know, non-musical? To a certain extent, or did he respect it?
We never had the conversation.
Really?
He, knowing my dad, he probably respected it because it was some form of art, right. And he was all about the art. I mean, my dad, you know, was one of the guys that discovered James Brown. So,
right. But I'm saying, like, if I was intrinsically involved in James Brown's career and then hip-hop comes along, I mean, I wouldn't blame somebody for not really being able to make the switch.
You want to blame somebody?
I wouldn't be able to blame somebody for maybe like, you know, if you grew up on James Brown and you don't really get hip hop, you know, I would do that. I understand.
So
the era has changed.
Yeah. So, but I think he just looked at it as art.
Right.
That's all it was.
Definitely. When did you start to realize that you really had aptitude for what you were doing and that you had a special talent for it?
I never considered myself an A&R guy. I always just considered myself a promotion and marketing guy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I feel I had the best A&R staff in the business. But I never said to myself, oh, wow, you know, this is what it is. To me, it was just like, where's the record? How are we going to get this record to the, you know, and cross that finish line?
Mm.
That's all I give a fuck about.
It's interesting because, like, now it feels like, you know, people who get into working in music or art, they tend to make it out as if this was their passion. This was like the only thing that they could do because it speaks to their soul. It's funny hearing you talk about it like it's this sort of like it was a trade at that time where it was just you found yourself doing it and
I loved it.
You adapted well to it, and but was there something about it where it was just so obvious to you that this was something that you loved above everything else that you could possibly be working in?
No, I mean, and I realized I wasn't going to become a professional basketball player. So, I mean, I was cool. Mm. Like, I enjoyed being on the road. I enjoyed that freedom. Had a lot of soul searching, 6-hour drives by yourself, you know, with no cell phone.
It's a crazy era to look back on.
Yeah.
We don't really ever get that anymore. It used to be like the flight was the time when you weren't on your phone. Which is kind of sad because you like probably are only on a flight every couple of weeks or so for the even if you're flying a lot, but yeah, I don't know. So I'm trying to get to you. Was there a moment where you sort of realized like, oh, I'm going to be able to make like a massive life changing amount of money from this? That this is going to fundamentally.
It's funny that you said when I sold the first 50% of my company,
right?
November 3rd, 1996. And maybe had close to $100,000 in the bank. A lot of money.
Right. You're young, too.
November 7th, 1996, I had north of 10.
Wow.
Right? And I woke up on November 8th. No, November 7th. And we signed the deal on November 6th. And it was a Friday. And I went to my wife at the time. I was like, I don't feel different.
Right.
And, she kicked me in the ass and said, get to the office and get to work.
Mm.
But, like I said, to me, I've never had a problem with any of my artists regarding money.
Really?
I won't fight over money.
Because I heard you talking about letting artists go quite frequently when they're just not happy anymore. Like, you just don't hold on to their contract and hang it over their
head. I never let an artist go, though. Nobody ever wanted to leave.
Right. Twista.
Yeah, we didn't have great success. So it's like, and Wu started blowing, and it was just, yeah, I guess he did.
That's just the one that I remember from the interview. You saying that he kind of moved along and you just let him go, which is not normally how record execs talk.
Yeah, so, but I mean, to this day, me and Twista are still cool. Like, there was never a fight about it.
If you had made it, a multi-year hellish process for him, you probably wouldn't be cool now.
Yeah, but then, I wouldn't be able to live with myself that way. So, because my thing was, I would get in BMG's ass. Like, you guys got to pay me.
Mm.
But when it came to the artist, and this is what I would always try and tell BMG. I got arrested for throwing a chair at an executive because they wouldn't give Wu-Tang an extra $20,000 on Raekwon's first album. And the point is, if you don't have artists and you don't have happy artists, you don't have a business.
Mm.
If you're going to put out music. So that's, you need to do right by the artist so they could do right by you, and then you could do whatever you have to do with your company.
Mm.
And if you're going to be in the music business and have a record company, you need them to deliver records.
Right. When you find an artist nowadays that you're looking at and you're excited about them, there has to have been artists over the years that you found where you felt like 100% sure they were going to be a superstar. And then there's got to be times where you got an artist where you were like, there's a smaller chance, 10, 20, 30% chance that I think this person could be huge. Like, how would you describe your confidence when you're looking at an artist, and how much of it is what you believe you can do for them versus just who they are?
At Loud, whatever we signed, I was confident. Mm. I signed Pun without hearing 1 ounce of music.
Really?
Joe could tell you the story. My head of A&R, who would never be in the office, showed up in the office for the meeting. I'm like, what are you doing here? And Maddie was like, I'm here for the meeting for Pun. The second they walked in, I'm like, who's your lawyer?
Mm-hmm.
And the deal literally got done within 24 hours. And Maddie's like, how are we going to sign without hearing music? I'm like, that's your job to do now.
Mm-hmm.
You're here for this meeting.
Right.
So my thinking from my dyslexia is probably a little bit off, and I don't think most people would have done that.
You don't think that you hearing a couple songs would have been additional information?
I mean, no, because I trusted you so much.
Right.
For you to be here for this meeting, this guy's a superstar, because you're the most stuck-up, like, hip-hop person you'll ever meet in your life.
Right.
I mean, he started the Unsigned Hype at the Source magazine.
Yeah, which was the biggest thing in the world for a while. That is funny, because there will be artists sometimes where, you know, a certain person will tell me to interview them, and it's like, I feel the same way. I was like, okay. Like, if you said it, then I know it's, and you know, certain people are very vested in their self-interest and other people aren't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when somebody tells, sometimes it's like, oh, I guess I don't have to hear it. I'll hear it, but it's like, I don't have to hear it immediately, because if you said they were worth interviewing, they're probably worth interviewing.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you have a staff, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's why you have friends, and, you know, it's...
You can read the tea leaves. You know?
Yeah.
You don't need, sometimes you don't need to hear the song. But, okay, to this day, though, one of your staff members comes and tells you there's an artist they want to sign. Like, how good of an ear? Like, there's a lot of talk of the ear in the music industry. Do you have massive confidence in your ear?
Not anymore.
Really?
I mean, I rely on people that I trust.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm close to 60. I mean, but you wouldn't want me to have a good ear right this second.
If I play you 20 Brooklyn rappers, you don't think you could tell me the best one?
I could tell you the one I like the best.
Right.
You got 20 on you?
I could probably scrounge up 20.
All right.
They're probably all going to suck for the most part. But the good ones are probably already signed these days. But that's interesting. Because I feel like I could usually pick out the
I mean, if you're going to come with some New York shit, right?
Right.
To me, it's all about the drum then and the kick. Like, and the record has to be aggressive. I don't want to hear any of that laid back. This, you know, I want to hear Annie Up. I want to hear hip hop. I want to hear Protect Your Neck. Mm. I want to hear Shook Ones.
Right. Yeah, same here. But people are always trying to convince me I should like some soft shit. And I'm just, sometimes it's hard to explain. I don't think I can judge that.
I mean, you could like whatever the fuck you want to like.
Mm.
And then if you have to sign something, you know, you got to trust your staff.
If you play me 20 R&B rappers or R&B singers, I feel like I would probably make the wrong decision about who the superstar is. Because that's just not really...
So you wouldn't go by the voice, you would go by the song?
I would probably go by someone on my staff. I would probably want to ask somebody else before I made that decision myself, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we had a girl by the name of Melanie Fiona at SRC.
Okay.
Voice was incredible, and she had a ballad called It Kills Me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really impressed by her manager. And her manager was just dope, like had a plan, had everything. But I was like, you know, I just signed four girls. Like, I'm going to sign another woman, you know? And, but I was just, I loved the record, and I was just really so impressed with Carmen on how she handled her business and the plan. So I was like, you know, I didn't know what to do, but you know, then one of my A&R people, who was a female, like, she's giving me a look like, if you don't sign it, I'm going to stab you.
Mm.
And then I opened my deal. I was like, you know what? I had 20 rappers at one time. So if I have five females, I have five females.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? Thank God I did sign it. You know, the record ended up being number one. And you know, we didn't hit gold, but we were close to gold.
Interesting. Have there been a lot of times where, are there artists that you look back on that you signed where you can like identify a critical moment where things just started to not work out? I guess I'm like more intrigued by the artists that you had a lot of faith in that didn't work out. Rather, you have so many success stories. That's kind of like the easy thing.
Dead Prez.
There was a moment where I felt like that was going to be the next Public Enemy, huh?
Yeah, I mean, they could have been. If they, trust is a really strong word, but if they understood, I'm not even going to say trust, right? If they understood where we were coming from as a label,
right,
they would have been PE.
Mm. It's hard to...
And they were young. Now we're like this.
Right.
Like M1 comes to LA, you know, every other month, and he's at the house, and we're just kicking it. If we had that relationship then... as we do now, they might have been the biggest group at Loud.
They saw you as kind of they wanted to have an adversarial relationship, or
I think they were just young, you know, and it was like, and I was white,
right?
And you know, they were so, you know, set in their ways and everything, and just but you know, we all, you know, they grew up. I didn't take it as personal.
That's why you only want to sign capitalist rappers.
No, I just,
unless they have a little anarchist streak in them, I don't know.
No, I mean, I just, you know, I just want to sign rappers that are going to make good music and they're going to be here 10 to 20 years from now.
Right. That one Dead Prez song that everybody knows.
Hip Hop?
Yeah.
It's probably my favorite record of all time.
Were you massively involved in like marketing that? And was that like the moment where it seemed like everything was going well?
I'll tell you where I heard the record. We just moved for the first time. We just moved into our brand new office. We had a whole floor. I had my own private bathroom, and I'm in the bathroom.
Uh-huh.
Setting it up. We just moved, and my A&R guys. So if you look at it like it was a U shape, you know, but we had the whole floor. I was in the corner, so I had my marketing team to my right and promotion team and my A&R team to my left.
Uh-huh.
And I was cleaning, putting stuff in. I never had my own private bathroom before, you know. And Sean C. started playing the record. I guess his office was right next to wherever the bathroom was. And I remember just running out. I'm like, what the fuck is this?
Uh-huh.
And he goes, it's Dead Prez. And I was like, when are we, you know, and it was just like, and it took a minute for us to put out the record. But if we dropped the record when I wanted to drop the record, which was, if I heard the record at 12 o'clock, I wanted that record out that night.
Right.
But it took another like 4 or 5 months.
And
I think the office lost momentum. As great as that record was, everything else like that, and just timing is everything. I mean, I was ready to go to Hot 97 and give it to Flex that night.
Right. But that song was huge. But
it got screwed up a little. I think inside the office.
Right.
I think, you know, people were getting, you know, not fed up with them, but it was just like, oh, here they go with, you know, whatever they, you know, they were saying.
Right. I guess it was probably like huge on more of like an indie type level, right? It wasn't like,
nah, that record should have been like, as big as that record was, that record should have been 5 times bigger than it was, six times bigger than it was.
Mm. Interesting. Okay. So going back to like why you feel like, actually that moment when you said that you went from 500,000 to 10 million in the course of a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did that cause you to sort of, you know, reflect back on why you were doing this in the first place? Or there, like you saying that your wife told you, just get back to work. I mean, that's interesting because, I mean, I feel like a lot of wives would be kind of like, we made it. Let's get in the yacht.
Nah. She said, get back to work.
Right. But you never considered sort of that your life maybe should change from all of a sudden getting that amount of money, you know? Like, I think we all kind of think about that from time to time. If you were to get that life-changing amount of money, how much would your life change, really?
I don't know if my life changed. You know what I did when I woke up? It was raining. I called up my lawyer, who was my cousin.
Mm-hmm.
One of my lawyers. I said, come on, I'm going to buy you a cell phone. Not everybody had cell phones in those days.
Right.
And I spent $200 on a cell phone. And I was like, what the fuck am I doing?
You didn't try to like become the giant iced out chain guy for a little while or anything?
Nah.
Just never really seemed appealing?
I tried it once and I returned everything that I bought.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it was.
I bought a grill.
Nah, I didn't have a grill.
You can't return that.
The only thing I kept was a dog tag, a diamond dog tag with my kids' names in the in the back. But. Right.
So you don't have any expensive habits going, or you just haven't managed to pick any up yet?
No, I mean, back in the day, I had real expensive. I mean, I had planes, I had cars, I had, you know.
Right.
I had everything.
But most of that's fallen by the wayside?
You get older.
Right.
And smarter.
Yeah, but if you really have money, like, you know, you see people take it to a logical extreme where all of a sudden you're Jay Leno and you got a fucking warehouse full of cars or whatever.
I was never into cars, though, so that was the whole thing. To me, it was really about the plane.
Mm. The private plane.
Yeah.
But was that really more of a convenience thing?
No, that was an ego thing.
Right.
That was just a straight ego thing.
Mm. But you, at what point did you decide to get rid of that?
When I got divorced.
Okay. Mm. Probably a lot of things. A lot of things made sense at that point.
I hear you.
Okay, so when you talk about, you know, working on this kind of stuff with your kids and everything, like what is your thought process on that now? Is it, do you feel lucky to just even be in the position to be able to maintain? A lot of people, you know, they can't even think of having a relationship with their kids into their 20s or 30s, well,
this,
right?
This is the thing. I feel lucky that I'm alive, right? Mm-hmm. I had a massive heart attack 7 years ago. I died 3 times, so I'm just happy I'm here.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And I have, besides Coop, who's my nephew, and my son, you know, my youngest son is signed to us. And my daughter, even though she's still in school, she's helping Coop a lot on the marketing side of things.
Mm. It's interesting because it feels like that's the kind of stuff that it's probably not that hard to convince your kids to be into.
No, mm-hmm. I mean, I just offered her $1 million to go to law school, and she said no.
Really?
Yeah.
You didn't want her to stay in this business?
No, I want her to go to law school. She said, I want to be rich and I don't want to rely on my husband.
Uh-huh.
I said, go to law school. She says, I'm not going to law school. I said, I'll give you $1 million. She said, no.
And she wants to work for you?
Yeah.
What is it about law school that you think would just give her a better life?
I don't know if it would give her a better life. I think she would just learn, I mean, just what her DNA is. She's really structured. And not necessarily to be a lawyer. She'll learn about contracts. She'll learn about negotiations. She'll learn about dealing with people.
She'd probably be more useful to you as a lawyer than as a music industry person, right?
If she was a lawyer, I think she would probably have the biggest practice in the business.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I think about that sometimes, like, how the hell am I going to convince my kid to go to school and try to become a doctor or a lawyer or whatever?
And, yeah, and I didn't go to school. And you're right. I didn't go to school. So they look at me like, before Rise, if they have a, like, you know, how to spell apple, I'm just, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
They're not going to call me. They're going to call their mom.
Right. Yeah, because, like, you live your life where you take all these risks, and then you look at your kid, and you're like, I want you to have this nice, steady, safe life that I didn't really have in me.
So, no, I would love them not to have a safe, I mean, I want them to be safe, but, like, I would like to, you know, let there be some bumps in the road for them so that they can learn.
Right.
And learn from their mistakes. I mean, I'm not going to let them drown. I'm not going to let anybody drown that's around me.
Right. But, you know, it's interesting because you think that, like, a lot of people build a business and then it just becomes, I think, you've seen Succession?
Yeah.
Where your kids are just not capable of running this business and it ends up being a massive, you know, problem to put your kids in charge of this business because just because they're related to you, there's no reason to believe that they would be good at this particular job. But your kids just sort of flock to it?
Nah, so we could start with Coop, who's my nephew, who's right there. I don't know if you guys see him.
Right.
He was always just an artist and just always into music, mm-hmm. and always entrepreneur, had his own cleaning service in school, so on and so on. Alex, my oldest son, was a college basketball player. Mm-hmm. So he's pretty disciplined.
Right.
Like, you know, and just training, you know, just, you know, however he got to that level. My daughter, I don't know where she came from. I mean, she doesn't play. She's like, boom, 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 boom. And I guess, you know, so it's, I'm hoping it's the best of her mom and the best of me, like, in one. And then her twin brother, who signed to the label, is me.
Right.
Has my temper, has my emotions, has my passion. And he just figures shit out on his own and without telling anybody, and he just does it.
Hmm.
And it works.
Is that weird to be around him, given that he reminds you of yourself so much?
Yeah, so we go at it because I, you know, the mistakes that I made. I try and, you know, have those conversations with him, but that's me. He didn't, you know.
Youth is wasted on the young.
But again, he's doing things now. Like, he has a record that's starting to pop now, and he's doing it all on his own, even though he signed to us.
Hmm. that's how it is these days often. Yeah. Does that freak you out a little when you see how big records can become without the label or any help these days?
Well, I think that's why we're going to win, because I've never needed a label.
Mm.
Even though I was a label, I never needed the major
right
to take me to the promised land.
Right.
It's like when I played in Macon for the first time, they laughed in my face. I said, this will be the biggest artist of my career.
Really?
And they all laughed, and I pretty much said, fuck you, I'll see you in a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
And my head of promotion, I said, his wife was pregnant. I said, you do the East Coast, I'll do the West Coast.
Uh-huh.
And if she gets pregnant, you have 5 days to take care of whatever you need. I mean, when she gives birth, you have a five-day break period. And it's funny, you know, he took Khan, and I took Akon's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget, there was no videos. We didn't make a video at that time, so nobody knew what Akon looked like.
Right.
So out in Utah, Akon's brother was Akon.
Uh-huh. You were really pulling this off.
Oh, yeah.
Well, on the radio?
On the radio, shows. Like,
you would have him doing shows.
Yeah, and I mean, he would be lip-singing, and just we did what we had to do.
That's incredible. I've thought about that before. That, like, you know, especially the rappers who are mass. I'm like, you could totally have a couple of these guys on the road at once.
Well, nobody knew what Akon looked like at the time because we didn't have a video.
Yeah.
Wow.
So when you say, like, I'll take the West Coast for the artist, it's like there's basically, like, two ways of doing what you guys do, right, where you could have you just dedicating every second of your day to bringing this artist to different labels, bringing them to you know, promotional opportunities, radio stations, et cetera. And then there's the thing that you have now where you have an actual company and you try to – actually take these roles and put them in various people's hands so that they can help grow this thing. What, with the Akon thing that you're talking about, though, were you, was it just full court press mode of you just bringing him everywhere you could and doing everything you could?
Again, somebody said to me, they laughed in my face. I don't take no well, and I don't like to lose. So I was like, all right, motherfuckers, I'll show you. Who in this room has sold more records than me anyway?
Right.
Including the chairman. So I was like, all right, fuck you.
Mm-hmm.
And we literally, and they gave us offices there. I said, nobody even go in there anymore.
Right.
Until this fucking record breaks.
Mm-hmm. And so how satisfactory was that when it actually happened?
Ego-wise, I mean, it was amazing.
Right.
But, you know, we still had a lot of work to do.
Right. Well, there's always a lot of work to do in this business, huh?
Damn.
That's crazy. Do you miss that period of having to do so much stuff in real life? I've been thinking about this a lot because, like, post-COVID, it's like, oh, now we get to all be around each other a lot more. I had really gotten used to not being around anybody. Now I got to get my mind back in that place.
That's a great question. I don't know how I feel right this second.
Mm.
I'm not rushing to get an office. I'm not rushing to get in an office yet. You know, what I did learn during the whole COVID thing is I'd rather be slow and smart than fast and stupid.
Mm. Do you feel like you were doing too much before?
Yeah. I mean, I was just like, because, you know, what I realize is the pace that I go at, not that many people could keep up with that pace anyway.
Right.
So that's how I'm looking at it.
When you say that pace, do you think of it more of like just the amount of hours of work that you're putting in every day, or are you kind of putting work on employees who maybe aren't able to fully like take care of it the way that you want them to?
I'm talking about executing what needs to be executed.
Right.
It's all about execution, right?
Mm.
So you could have the best idea in the world, but if you don't execute it, what do you have?
Right.
Nothing.
Do you do you pay a lot of attention to balance in your life at this point? Are you a person who's kind of at risk of overworking themselves and just going too hard to the point where it's kind of ridiculous?
I mean, we had the BET Awards this weekend. So, you know, I was managing X when he passed.
Mm.
So this weekend was a lot. It was a lot of rehearsals and we closed the show. So, like, I didn't drive here. Like, I was going to drive here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know what? I had a meeting, had a lunch. I was like, you know, I'm going to Uber and I'm going to take a 30-minute nap on my way from the house to here.
Right.
And it worked to perfection.
That's your idea of balance, is a 30-minute nap in the Uber?
That kind of says a lot.
I put, you know, listened to some music, didn't pick up a call, Right. Returned one text, and that was it.
Is your phone just exploding at all times?
Not 24/7, but there's hours of the day that I just want to throw the phone in the pool.
Right.
And let me come back a few hours after that and just...
Yeah. I feel like I've set a really good precedent by just like kind of not picking up the phone. And sometimes I see my friends who pick up the phone to anyone who wants to talk to them. And I'm like, you're never going to be able to get anything done if you live like this.
Yeah. So that's my issue. It's like, I got to pick up every call that I see.
Mm. Yeah. A lot of the most successful people I know are like that. They just really are that attentive to every relationship.
It's all about the relationships.
Mm.
No matter what business you're in.
It is. But you have to stay on top of them. That's the thing I have a real hard time with. I can like spark the relationship off, but then the maintenance required is...
Then it's not really a relationship. You're just trying to get it back.
Or do a podcast. Yeah, there's some truth to that. So you're in the office at what time you wake up and what time are you in the office?
I wake up at 5.
Okay. And you're in the office by...
Well, I don't have an office anymore.
Oh, okay. You're working from home strictly right now?
Yeah. So I wake up at 5. I start my meditation at 5:15 to 5:35.
Okay.
I read the papers.
The literal newspaper, or you read on your phone?
I read it on my iPad, but they're papers.
Got it.
That goes around 6:15. And then I walk the dogs for 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Come back, I do another meditation for 20 minutes.
You're answering emails and texting while you're walking the dogs, or is that...
Nope, I don't even bring my phone with me.
Okay.
It's just me talking to the dogs.
Mm.
And then get back around 7:45. And I'll just... I don't know what I'll do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll look at some emails, but I won't return emails yet. I'll just look at them, maybe start writing some notes, and I won't start my day until really 9:30. I won't pick up the phone before that.
Okay. And do you feel like you have lost much by not having the office physically together, or do you feel like that was kind of overrated and you can only see that now?
I can only see that now. Mm. So before COVID, I would be in the office at 7:30.
Mm-hmm. Before almost everybody else, I'm assuming?
I would be there, yeah, way before everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd go to around... I'd go 7 to 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then... but now it's just...
You think you're happier now?
That's a good question. I don't know if I'm happier now, but I'm more at peace.
I think not spending 12 hours in the office is probably good for your mental health.
But I'm still spending 12 hours working.
Yeah.
But I'm not spending 12 hours working anymore because I really won't start my day now until 9.
Right.
So to me, I used to make a call sheet. I still make a call sheet, but if I didn't have 150 calls that I made that day, I thought I was doing something wrong.
Mm. So those are like important elements of the
business.
I didn't even
know if they were important. Like you talk about maintaining a relationship, right?
Right.
So say we met. All of a sudden, if you're on my call sheet, I'm calling you every day now. Like, okay. You know, and I don't talk on the phone long. I can't talk on the phone long.
Right.
Right? So it's like, check in, you good? Yeah. Hang up. And I would cross it off.
Interesting. Call sheet. I never even thought about that. Of like, these are the people that you're going to actually go out of your way to stay in touch with. Interesting.
You know, if you make 10 calls a day, just 10, that 10 is going to turn into 20. And things are going to start happening.
Mm. Interesting. How important do you think it is to go out? Clubs, album releases, events, shit like that. How much?
For me now?
Yeah.
Zero.
Close to none or none?
None.
Okay.
I mean, but if Coop and my son are not going, then that's a problem.
Mm. So you think that's very much necessary for people in their 30s.
They need to be seen. Not necessary to, you know, there's a saying that my father, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Mm.
So them meeting people and them getting, you never know where that person's going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
That person could be head of Apple Music one day. That person could be head of Sony Music one day. or he could be, you know, head of Spotify, or just, you know, whatever. You never know where they're going to end up. You never know where you're going to end up either.
Right.
And what you're going to need. So it's even like, you know, if you're in the A&R department and you pass on somebody, pass in a nice way, because you know what? That somebody that you passed on might have a neighbor that could be the next Drake. And even though he's not working with Drake, he says, hey, you guys could go, you should check this out. So you never know where these relationships end up. Right. So that's why I'll return every call and pick up every call that I see.
Mm. Definitely. It makes sense. You have a bunch of artists in your head that you like wish that you didn't miss early on?
I mean, I wish BMG let me sign Rockefeller.
Oh, wow.
And then with them, you know, he was brought to us first, but he was an underground rapper, and I think it was just a perfect storm with him and Dre. I don't know. He would have still been Eminem, but I don't know if he would have sold 300 million records at Loud.
Right.
Just how he was built and how my A&R staff was built. Mm. Would have been an amazing relationship. And he could have sold, you know, maybe 10 million records, right, but not who he was.
That Dr. Dre association really...
I mean, that was just a perfect marriage.
Yeah. Compare that to Vanilla Ice. Vanilla Ice had no cosign.
Vanilla Ice didn't have Dr. Dre.
But if Vanilla Ice had, you know, even not Dr. Dre, but a Dr. Dre, somebody even close to be their figure guiding them into the game, it could have been a lot different. Because I read this article about how Vanilla Ice was very much respected and appreciated in his local scene before he came out. And then there was this SNL skit that just lampooned him. And that was just kind of changed his whole image after that.
And then the movie also hurt him.
Which was it?
I forget the name of it, but he did a movie pretty much.
What was it? Cool as Ice. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, he's still out here doing it.
Yeah.
Shout out to him. Okay, so in terms of, like, how many artists would you say that you guys are working on at this point?
We got five.
Five, that's it. And you don't want more than that?
No, we're going to put out a single a week.
Mm.
By a brand new artist every week, 52 artists.
Right. Is it... I mean, you put out a single per week, but do you feel like that's enough these days? Or like what has to surround each single to make it an event, right?
No, we're not even going to make it an event, right? So at the end of the day, some of the biggest artists in my career started off as single deals. Wu-Tang started off as a single deal. Akon started off as a single deal. 3-6 started off as a single deal. So if we put out 52 singles by 52 different artists, and forget about music-wise, just 52.
Right.
Three are going to pop. If I do something, if I don't do anything.
Okay.
Just on straight numbers. So that's, you know, and with taking care of the creative community.
Mm. For sure. How do you see the media at this point in the business that you're in? You know, it's like it's changed so much where it went from, you know, having a couple of authoritative sources that were sort of, you know, the must-read content for everybody in the game. Now it's so spread out. But there's still, you know, I guess you could argue that there are, like, authoritative sources at this point. There's you know, the big ones that everybody's sort of familiar with and everything. But how much do you see, you know, finesse in the media or having relationships with media? Like, how much does this matter in terms of pushing artists these days?
I think it's important.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's important. You know, your media...
Right.
Right. So, I mean,
it's taken many strange forms.
You know, you have a foundation and a base and an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, if we sign, you know, this bottle of water and we're trying to crack your audience, we need you.
Right. So, you know, you're pushing an artist for the first time, though. Like, is it important for you that they get on all these Instagram accounts of all these, like, how much out of your way do you go to sort of, you know, start seeding them into these roles?
At first, I didn't think so. And then we had a lunch on this past Friday with some executives.
Uh-huh.
And, again, this was what, you know, my son and Cooper, you know, were, they were saying, you know, we need these Instagram accounts. We need you. You know, I always knew that we needed YouTube. And I was like, we need to just attack the streets. And they said, this is the streets. And I was just like, I can't see Instagram being the streets, but I guess I was proven wrong on Friday.
Yeah, it's not even so much that it's the streets so much as that it's just everything to so many people now.
Yeah,
and, other social media matters as well, but Instagram's really the one.
But to me, it's still, you need to focus on what your audience is.
Mm.
You know, I'd rather have a smaller audience and knowing that are going to be loyal than, I'd rather have 500 likes than 5,000 likes if the other, 4,500 people are never going to come and see anything.
Mm. But like the essence of having a really big artist is that you have a lot of very uninvolved participants taking this in. Like that's one thing you realize over time is that like you can have 1,000 hardcore fans, but if you're going to get to having 1,000,000 fans, you're probably not going to have 1,000,000 hardcore fans. You're going to have a whole lot of people who just kind of know about you.
But you know what? I'd rather if you're going to have 1,000,000 fans, then I need to have at least 60% that are super fans.
Mm. Interesting. Okay. So some of the long pauses that you've been doing have kind of got me. I'm like, not really sure like where exactly to hop in there.
You can hop in wherever you want.
Okay. okay. So what are you excited about right now? And is Loud back? I was reading that and then I'm like, I'm not hearing you mention it. So I'm like,
no,
that's not the case.
So I licensed, Sony owns the name for Loud Records.
Okay.
So there's a Loud music group that I was on the board of, and just, they still can't, they could sign whatever they want to sign, but anything created for the brand itself, but I'm not involved with it whatsoever.
Okay. Was that something at one point where you wanted to have that name again? Would that mean something to you for the family?
I mean, I still own Loud, Loud, I just can't put out records under Loud Records, but I still own the name Loud Records.
Right.
You know what? It's not fair for the new artists, and it's not fair for the old artists. You know, it's like I could go on Instagram now and say, hey, give me 16, right?
Mm.
And it's going to be all New York shit from the 80s and the 90s. Like, it's not going to be what's going on now. So I'm at the point where it's just like, my dad, so the new company that we have is called Spring Sound.
Mm-hmm.
My dad's label was called Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And paying homage to him, I said, I'm going to do it. I called up all my cousins. I said, is it cool that I do this? And they said, yeah.
That felt like it was, sort of carrying on the legacy to an extent.
I just, it's not even really about the legacy. It's really about just paying my dad respect.
Mm.
And my uncle's still alive, but he's just old. But it's really paying them respect and saying, if it wasn't for you guys, I wouldn't be here.
Mm. It's interesting because I feel like, or do you feel like for a younger, newer artist that being associated with anything that feels old school is sometimes not a good thing? And that the Loud name, like to a lot of people, just reads as like,
yeah, but
legacy,
the thing, but
classic
the,
label.
But the thing is, their parents knew what Loud was, right?
Right.
So,
and that's kind of what a lot of kids don't want. They don't want to support anything that their parents would know about.
The kid that we signed out of Oregon, his dad is a huge Wu fan.
Mm.
So even though it's not called Loud, I mean, Bird is just ecstatic.
Mm.
So,
I mean, at least Loud went away for a while, so that would explain why like the younger generation might not know about it. When you think about something like Def Jam, it's like Def Jam's been active all these years and nobody gives a fuck about the brand name.
Yeah, I mean, just they put out horrible records.
I mean, it just feels like it's kind of, that's sad. Like even when I was young and the Def Jam video game was out, it already kind of felt like, oh, okay, yeah. Like, I guess that's still a pretty significant label, mm-hmm. but yeah, that's certainly
changed. I mean, no, they're a major, but you know what? They still got Kanye, they got Rihanna, they got Justin, but now they just got to figure out what their team is inside,
right,
and break some new artists.
And they can have all those artists, it's just that the audience doesn't associate with any of those artists with the label regardless.
Yeah, because they're not executing what's going on today.
Mm. Interesting. The DMX Like, how would you describe where DMX was at in his life prior to recent events?
He was happy.
Really? He was starting to get there?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't around during the Rough Rider days. I was around, but I you know, I wasn't managing him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was really finding, you know, the last 3 years that I was with him, from the first day until right before he passed, I mean, the growth and the peace and the happiness that he was trying to find was incredible.
He was really on that path. He was trying to find that. Interesting.
I mean, I'll tell you, so, like right after Versus, you know, that he did with Snoop, a few days later, I go visit my mom and I come back and he's in my backyard taking care of one of my dogs who just had an operation and he was feeding him a sandwich. He goes, "We got to get his confidence back." And he would show up every day at 4 o'clock to give the dog a sandwich, play with him, and just like for an hour, like he was a physical therapist.
Wow. That's crazy.
And he goes, "You don't mind?" I'm like, you know, and like I would, if I wasn't there and come, I would always end up seeing him at the end of it, you know, or, you know, there'd be times when I didn't have anything. But, I mean, if you weren't at peace and trying to find happiness, you wouldn't be in my backyard every day giving my dog a turkey sandwich.
Right.
And getting his confidence back.
Yeah. I mean, that's crazy that dog connection that he had extends to all kinds of people's dogs that he didn't even...
I mean, I just bought another one. I'm getting it in 6 weeks.
Another dog?
Yeah. And I'm naming him D. Well, it's a she.
Oh, okay.
But...
Boomer.
Boomer's not really a female name.
That's a good point. Oh, man. I just interviewed Corrupt, and he was talking about how he just randomly ran into DMX in the airport, and they had beef for all these years over Foxy Brown. And because allegedly DMX was sleeping with her while they were married or whatever, and he runs into him in the airport, and they both miss their flights because they're just hanging out and drinking and just having a great time. And I mean, it feels like a lot of people kind of had that sort of feeling about DMX towards the end of his life, that he was really making that effort to change his life.
Method Man told me a story yesterday about he. It's probably one of the best stories I ever heard in my life. Okay. I'm going to try and say it, and I'm sure I'm going to fuck it up somehow, some way.
Take it for granted that Method Man might have a rhetorical style that is missing here.
So the funny thing is, somebody sent me the article, but them being interviewed together. So I guess, I don't know if they were doing a movie together or if they were shooting some type of commercial or whatever. And, you know, there were cops on the set. Mm-hmm. And X went to Meth and he said, come on, let's take the car. And they jump into the car and they pulled somebody over. And X gets out of the car, asks for a registration and license. And this person gives him the registration and license. And X told him that you shouldn't be speeding and that, you know, I'm going to give you a pass and just go on your merry way.
And
I mean, I had tears. I'm fucking up the story.
Right.
But I had tears last night when I heard the story. And then Meth manager, it's on my phone. I'll show you, like, sent me this text this morning at the crack of dawn because I guess they took the red eye after the awards. And there's this interview, somebody interviewing Meth and X. And they're telling the story.
Uh-huh. Wow. And they just took the cop car and the cops didn't care?
I'm sure they did. Maybe the cops didn't know.
I thought that the story was going to end totally different. When I heard they took the cop's car, I'm like, oh, dear God, what's going to happen? But, okay, that's good. Jesus. Yeah, I mean, rest in peace, DMX, man. That's crazy. Is there anything left in this game that you feel like you want to accomplish? Any particular targets, things that you haven't done yet that you want to accomplish?
I mean, I pretty much accomplished everything, but I want this label because we own it 100%. I'm not with a major.
Mm.
I want it to be the biggest label I've had.
Right.
So, like, every view on YouTube is ours.
Mm.
Every, you know, whatever, you know, so this is us 100%, and we're going 50-50 with every artist that we sign.
Right.
So I want this label, I mean, they've all both meant the world to me.
Uh-huh.
But, like, this is just a different feeling. Like, I looked over the weekend, I looked on how many views I've had on YouTube uh-huh. with all my artists. And it's north of 5 billion views.
Right.
So it's like, all right, how much money is that? Yeah. So that's what I want.
Mm. Definitely.
Because I never saw that money.
Right. And I mean, now, you know, the game has changed. But does it feel like that challenge of, like, doing it without the majors? Is that just... Is it such an overwhelming challenge? Like, do you feel like it's going to feel like a completely different thing to reach a level of success without them?
It's my money. So right. It's definitely going to be a different challenge. Before, I was playing with the house's money.
Mm. But they have... would you say that the labels have a lot available to them that you don't have available to you at this point?
What do they have? They have the catalog that if they have a really fucked up year, they could live off their catalog.
Right.
You're not going to tell me they have a better relationship at radio than me. You're not going to tell me they have a better relationship with Leo Cohn than me. You're not going to tell me they have a better relationship with Apple or Spotify than me. They might be able to bargain more, but when it comes to one-on-one, they can't touch me.
Impressive. Steve Rifkin.
Thank you.
Appreciate you, man.
All right. That's a good conversation.
Appreciate you, man. Steve Rifkin, No Jumper, coolest podcast in the world. Check us on YouTube, SoundCloud, iTunes. Like, comment, subscribe. NoJumper.com if you want to support. And Friday, we'll be listening to your music on stream. Appreciate y'all.
All right. Thank you.